Welcome to the Chochmat Nashim podcast. Anne, Shoshana, and Rachel are still on their summer hiatus, but we'll be back with brand new episodes coming right after the Chagim. In the interim, listen to this classic episode, an interview with Rabbi Chuck Davidson about conversion in the state of Israel, entitled, There Are Jews, and Then There Are Jews.
This is the Chochmat Nashim podcast on JewishCoffeeHouse.com. Because Judaism is better when women are heard. Now, here are Rachel Stomel, Ann Gordon, and Shoshana Keats-Jaskal.
Hello, this is Ann Gordon with the Chochmat Nashim podcast. I'm here with Shoshana Keats-Jaskal.
Hello.
And Rachel Stomel.
Hello.
We're hosting tonight Rabbi Chuck Davidson, who has made a name for himself on the topics of conversion and marriage outside of the Rabbanut. Tonight, we're talking about conversion. Chuck.
I got interested in the conversion issue probably around 12, 13 years ago. It all started, I was actually at the time the director of marketing for the Jewish Agency for Israel, and I was exposed to the Russian Olim, and exposed to any number of the issues that their specific challenges that they face, and to certain demographics. One of the demographics is that among the 1 million people who made Aliyah from the former Soviet Union, approximately 400,000 are not halachically Jewish.
What does that mean exactly?
A good question. So in Russia, in the Soviet Union, identity went primarily by the father. And of course, in Israel, or at least according to halacha, it goes by the mother. So there were many who, first of all, to make Aliyah, you don't need to be Jewish. You have to have one Jewish grandparent. But in addition to that, many people defined or identified themselves as Jews based on their patrilineal descent. And in terms of halacha, they are in fact not Jewish.
But they think they are.
But their identity is fully so. The vast majority of them, there is a minority, but the vast majority of them, even who are not halachically Jewish, are in fact, in terms of their own identity, Jewish. There was a joke among them in the previous generation. I got onto the flight in Moscow as a Jew, and I landed in Ben-Gurion as a Goy. It's a real problem. It's a real problem on so many levels. One of the issues that concerned me at the time was the issue of intermarriage. In Israel before 1989, before 1990, give or take, the late 80s, the intermarriage rate was 0.5%.
Meaning before this Russian Aliyah.
Correct. And today it's holding at 5%. That means it grew tenfold. And that growth
only,
is...
I'm sorry to
it's okay,
keep interrupting. Please. We're going to all keep interrupting.
It's good.
It's grown simply because of Israeli Jews marrying Russian not quite Jews?
Very good. You raised a good terminology issue. The answer is yes. And the way I define this group is, or it's not just them, it is a large group of Jews throughout the world. I refer to them, it's my own terminology, to help me understand and express myself, non-halachically Jewish Jews.
Okay.
In fact, they are Jews in every way imaginable, except halachically.
Okay, I think for our audience, also for me, let's because this is very strange for people who are maybe from English-speaking countries. What does it mean to be a Jew in every way except halacha? What does it actually mean? Give us an example of what this family looks like or does or practices or does not practice.
Right. So in the second gen, let's take the Russians as an example. They're not the only group, and they're probably not even the largest. But let's take them as an example. If you take the second generation of Russians, meaning they were born here or were born or grew up here from, you know, from a very young age. Research came out maybe 2, maybe 3 years ago, I don't remember, indicating that they are absolutely no different than the average Israeli.
How does the average in what way? What does that mean?
Imagine the average Israeli. What does the average Israeli do? The average Israeli observes Shabbat, not in a halachic way, but Shabbat is a different day for the average Israeli. The average Israeli, celebrates the Jewish holidays, and not, you know, any other holidays. The average Israeli, you know, has a bar mitzvah. The average Israeli gives a brit milah to their sons.
Is that true statistically? The
yes.
Average Israeli has a bar mitzvah? Really?
Yes.
Okay.
In the meantime.
Meaning more than 50% of Israelis?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge. I don't remember the exact stats. But the average Israeli is Jewish. You know, I mean, not just halachically so, but they act like Jews.
I mean, culturally. Like there's a kind of a cultural identity of being Jewish that you're referring to.
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting question. What is Judaism? Is it a nationality? Is it a tribal identity? Is it a religious identity? Is it a cultural identity? And the answer is anybody who tells you they know doesn't know what they're talking about because there is no clear answer. But you look at them and you smell and, you know, you sniff and they
smells like a Jew.
Yeah. I mean, not literally. They're Jews. And so the point is that the average second generation Russian is absolutely no different. Not in terms of basic Jewish faith points, you know, they believe in God in one way or another, and also in terms of their behavior, they have Jewish behaviors that are similar to that are exactly the same as the average Israeli. That is what I call a non-halachically Jewish Jew. They are Jewish, but not halachically so.
I grew up not religious, but my family was very culturally Jewish, right? Right. My father's family specifically was very culturally Jewish. We identified as Jews. We were not religious. We didn't do that crazy stuff, but we were proud Jews.
Right. Same here.
Mm-hmm.
And now you were
halachically Jewish Jews.
We were halachically
yes,
Jewish
and,
Jews.
Yes, and the group we're talking about is not halachically Jewish, but they are Jews.
Do they
Jews.
Care?
Oh, that's a great question.
Wait, before we get to that, I just want to clarify something, because my understanding of the Jews of the former Soviet Union is that they were kind of stamped Jew on their identity papers, but were particularly not Jewish in their identity because of the Soviet erasure of all religion.
Not religious. That is correct. But in fact, what kept the Jewish spark alive, we can thank the Soviets for this, that the only thing perhaps some of them knew was in their identity card, it said Jewish. And that's what, in fact, kept their identity. They were stamped as Jewish, and so they were Jewish. We can thank the Soviets for that.
So you said that, you know, that these Israelis are growing up culturally or, you know, nationalistically Jewish, however you would want to define that. When did these people actually realize that they weren't halachically Jewish, or when did they realize that this was a problem?
Well, it depends. I mean, it depends on each individual.
Because I know, like, a lot of people, like in the army, for example, they realize that they aren't in fact Jews, or when they go to sign out to be married, that they're told a few weeks before their wedding, surprise, you're not Jewish,
right.
You can't get married.
Right.
Like, when does this come up for these people?
Very good. So it depends on the person, but basically, because Israeli society has already accepted them as Jewish, I'm talking in broad strokes, they don't run up against this except when they come to get married. Israel is a democratic society, and so every citizen has the same rights, except when it comes to marriage. In marriage, there is no such thing as civil marriage in Israel, and therefore you can only get married through your religious affiliation, meaning Christians get married through the church, Muslims get married through Islamic law, and Jews get married only through the Rabbanut. There is no other way to get married. So a person who, let's say, made Aliyah from Russia and is not recognized as Jewish by the Rabbanut has no way to get married in the state of Israel. None. Zero. They cannot get married here. And that's when they
legally.
Run into they cannot get married in a way that is legally of course. You're right. They cannot get married in a way that is legally recognized as married in the state of Israel. That is correct.
So what kind of repercussions does that have for them?
The same repercussions for anyone else who can't get married. They have two options, I guess, is how I'll address the question. They can go to Cyprus or Prague or Las Vegas or anywhere else and get married civilly in a foreign country, and then come back and register as a married couple in the Sirat HaPanim, the Ministry of Interior. They then have the full rights and responsibilities of any other married couple. Or they can live as Yiduim Tzibor, which means common law marriage. Israel recognizes common law marriage. They can just live with their partner as commonly married, I suppose that's the word. And the rights and obligations are very close to those of a formally married couple, but not exactly the same. So those are the two options that they have. They run into this problem of not being halachically Jewish only when they come to get married, also when they come to get buried. There's a bit of an issue there as well.
And are their children recognized as having two parents? If they're not halachically and religiously married through the Rabbanut, are their children, what are their children?
The legal status of their children, if they're registered as a married couple in the Interior Ministry as a result of a marriage performed outside of Israel, then their children are recognized as they have the legal status of their children.
But not necessarily Jewish status as well.
Well,
it doesn't
the
matter.
Mother or the father who's
it doesn't matter.
Jewish.
It doesn't matter until
Until the child wants to get married.
Exactly. You should know that the state does not agree on who Jewish is. It gets very complex, and I'll try to simplify it. The Interior Ministry has its definition. There are plenty of people that are registered as Jewish in the Interior Ministry that are not recognized as such by the Rabbanut. You can ask, what is the practical ramification of being registered as Jewish or not Jewish in the Interior Ministry? And the simple answer is there is none. It's purely psychological.
I should point out...
Purely psychological.
I wanted to point this out before when you mentioned, but I didn't want to interrupt you. It's important in case people forget, and I think people do forget, that the reason someone can make aliyah with one Jewish grandparent is because that was Hitler's criteria for who gets killed as a Jew. So the Israeli government said, if you were going to be killed by Hitler for being Jewish, that Jewish, you can make aliyah being that Jewish. And that is almost at the center of this issue of identity.
That's correct.
So now that we've established this, what about converting them? You know, we've got a state, we have a Jewish majority, Jewish democratic country. Do we want to convert them? Should they be converted? What are the issues with conversion? And
are they happy to convert? I remember there being large issues with the Ethiopian community.
Right.
You know, with the issues of conversion, where they always thought they were Jewish and they were, whatever. It's a separate conversation. We should maybe discuss Ethiopians another time, but they were not so happy to convert, at least initially.
Right. So the first thing is that they've already converted sociologically, not halachically. And that is borne out by this research that was done about 2.5 or 3 years ago, whenever it was, that they have undergone a sociological conversion and that they are no different than the average Israeli Jew. That's number one. Number two is, when you say, do we want them to convert? It depends on who we is. The answer is that I suppose the religious community should want them to convert because we care about the halachic definition of a Jew. And if they don't convert, I'm talking about we only as Orthodox Jews, as halachically, you know, observant Jews. If we care about halacha, then of course we don't want our children to marry someone who is halachically not Jewish. Even if they are Jewish in every other way, we want them to be halachically Jewish as well. So if we is the religious community, then yes, we would like them to convert, because guess what? The intermarriage rate now is at 5%, one out of every 20 marriages. And for sure, almost every religious family will have someone halachically intermarrying, meaning marrying someone who is Jewish but not halachically so. The moment a person becomes no longer observant, they don't really care whether the person, on average, I'm talking in broad strokes, they don't really care if the spouse is halachically Jewish or not. They're Jewish enough for the vast majority of Israelis. So if we, as religiously observant Jews, care about our great-grandchildren being halachically Jewish, then we should certainly want them to convert.
Can you fill us in a little bit on the issues of conversion? Like why it's not an easy thing, or is it an easy thing to convert them? You know, I've heard you discuss in the past the history of how conversion used to work, how it does work today by the Rabbanut,
right?
And the complications.
Right. So the Rabbanut has created a very problematic conversion system, in my opinion. They have, in practice...
I think we share your opinion.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'll expand on that. Number one is that they have already adopted certain positions in halakha which allow the conversion of a person who will not be observant, or certainly not fully observant. They have already adopted those positions in halakha, but not transparently.
So again, just to clarify, because I certainly grew up thinking that, you know, to convert to Judaism, the whole idea is that you take on a commitment to keeping the commandments and that you're going to join the Jewish people in all that they entail, all that we entail.
Or that when someone wants to convert, you are supposed to push them away and try to discourage them and try to make it hard for them. And it seems like we've gone a bit overboard with that.
You're supposed to push them away 3 times, right? Have you ever heard
that's
that?
That's what we always
yes.
taught.
Yes.
That appears in a midrash.
I don't know how true that is.
It appears in a midrash root. It is brought nowhere in any of the halachic codes.
But everyone knows it.
Among the great rabbinic scholars, there is a big dispute about what acceptance of the commandments means. According to some of the great rabbis, that means they are committing to an observant lifestyle. That, in my opinion, is a minority view. I've written a lot about this. In my opinion, it means that the person is accepting upon themselves to become Jewish with all that entails.
I once taught someone for conversion years and years ago. She said that at the mikveh beforehand, I'm not exactly sure, they said to her, you know, do you know there was a Holocaust? If there would ever be another Holocaust, you would be subject to whatever anti-Semitism would, I don't know, bring about for you. Of course, she was actually also a patrilineal descent Jew already, so she already would have been in trouble, but that be that as it may. She right. said, my point is that she found it really inhibiting. Like, she went through with it. It wasn't going to deter her at that point, but she was startled right. by the severity of that comment.
Right. We want a convert to make an informed decision. And therefore, they need to, at least at some basic level, know what they're getting into. And so we tell the convert that there's such a thing as mitzvot, that there's such a thing as commandments. And we mention to them, we inform them of some of the more weighty commandments and some of the less weighty commandments. And we inform them that according to Jewish tradition, there is such a thing as punishment and reward. How that exactly works, God knows, literally. But the concept exists. And that, yes, that there's lots of anti-Semitism in the world and people hate us. We want them to make an informed decision. If they
we after, don't get to make an informed decision.
We don't. That's correct. Born Jews have no such. And by the way, once a convert converts, they also, it's a one-way ticket. There is no way out. Just like, by the way, a convert is also a born Jew. There is no such thing as someone who's not born Jewish.
What do you mean?
Very good. You are either born physically, biologically to a Jewish mother, which makes you a born Jew, or you convert. When you convert, you are born again. Now that sounds Christian, but guess what? The Christians took it from us, not the other way around. Gershenit gayer ketinok shenolad dami. A person who converts is as if a newborn child. That's our concept. We created it, not the Christians. So when a convert converts, they are born again to a Jewish mother. Who is the Jewish mother? Sarah Imenu. Sarah, our mother. That is their mother. Their mother is Sarah Imenu. So there is only one way to become Jewish, and that is to be born Jewish. Some people are born at birth Jewish, and some people are reborn as Jewish.
So the yap about recanting Ivanka Trump's conversion is nonsense.
There is no way to reverse a conversion. No such thing exists. It is quite clear, in my opinion, in halakha, that if a person walks out of the mikveh, which is the last stage of conversion, walks out onto the street and crosses the street and goes into church and prays, the person is still halachically Jewish. They're a meshumad. A meshumad is a person who converts out of Judaism, who leaves Judaism to another religion. Halachically, a person who leaves Judaism to another religion is still considered Jewish.
My understanding is that we've got 300,000 to 350,000 Jews that are not halachically Jewish in the state of Israel right now. And my question really is, and I've spoken to a number of people, but I won't get into it. What do you think we should be doing, right? Because the Rabbanut, my understanding is they convert maybe 2,000 a year, and there's actually 5,000 children born every year to those 350,000. So it's a numbers game that we're losing. The question is, what do we do now that we understand the background? What do we do?
Okay, it's a good question. First of all, I'm assuming that we is the Orthodox Jewish community, because the larger Israeli society has already decided what to do, and that is to accept them. So if we're talking about...
What does
about,
that mean to accept them?
They look at them as Jewish. You're Jewish. You're no different than me. You're Jewish. End of story. Happy to marry you, happy to build a family with you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And they go to Cyprus where they live as common law married.
Correct. Correct. So if we as the Orthodox community, first of all, quick thing on the numbers. The Rabbanut converts, the last number that I'm familiar with is 1,600 per year. It wavers back and forth, but call it 2,000. Let's be generous. 2,000 per year. Another 4,000 are born to this cohort. That is the halachically non-Jewish Jews every year. So this cohort grows by 4,000 by natural birth, and another 4,000 make aliyah. That means there is a net growth in non-halachically Jewish Jews of 6,000 per year. That's number one. What should we do about it? In my opinion, what we should do about it is adopt the positions that the Rabbanut has already adopted, but transparently. That is to say, we should B, converting them. If they wish to convert as to being a halachic Jew, we should convert them, even though we know that they will not be fully observant or even close to fully observant. If they are living a life like the average Israeli Jew and they want to be like their Jewish neighbor, who is so-called chiloni, or most secular Jews who define themselves as secular Jews in Israel are in fact traditional to some extent. If they're living a life like the average Israeli Jew, we should be happy to convert them. And we should do that transparently. The Rabbanut is already doing that, but not transparently. In other words, they're making the converts or encouraging the converts to lie about the extent to which they will be observant. Everyone knows it. The rabbinic judges on the courts know it. The converts themselves know it. And what it does is it teaches it teaches the convert that the way to enter halachic Judaism is via dishonesty.
The lie is that they're going to be keeping everything, but yes, they're not really going to be keeping
it. Of course not.
Okay.
95% at least of the converts who go through the Rabbanut do not come out as fully observant Jews. They come out like the average Israeli.
Chuck, for
so
those?
Do you feel like that kind of cheapens the whole process?
No, it's much, much worse than cheapens. It's a tremendous Chilul Hashem, a tremendous Chilul Hashem. Again, it is teaching people the way into Judaism or halachic Judaism is via dishonesty.
For those people who have grown up with those, you know, messages of turn them away and they have to be really sincere and who really are having a very hard time, because I think for people, again, from Anglo communities, that conversion is so rare for us to have grown up with. But for those who really feel like, how can you do that? How can you make conversion easier when we know it's supposed to be so hard? What is the response? Is there a halachic room to say, well, you know, there's Eretz Yisrael or they're already living here. People have converted into Judaism before en masse in our history. You know, what can we say to those people who are very much against this idea, who feel right, it's wrong?
And also, shouldn't we have a standard, a universal standard of this is what it takes to be a Jew?
There is no way to standardize conversion. It cannot be standardized. And all of these attempts to standardize will have failed and will fail and are just wrong. And I'll explain. There is no such thing as a standard person. There is no such thing as a standard family which that person may marry into. There is no such thing as a standard community. Conversion cannot be standardized. This perhaps is the reason that Chazal and the Talmud and the Rishonim, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch never set out standards except for a few very broad strokes, very, very broad, because it can't be standardized. So I am totally opposed to standardizing conversion. It cannot be done and it should not be done. Regarding your question, the halachic basis for being more open and accepting a conversion and not being tremendously strict is very simple. You open up the Talmud in Yevamot. You open up the Rambam in Hilchot Isurei Biyah, the 13th and 14th chapters. You open up the Shulchan Aruch. None of what goes on today is described in those sources. If you learn the sources through the ages until relatively recent modern times, conversion looked nothing like what it looks like today. It wasn't such a long process. The convert did not learn very much at all before converting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. People will say that times have changed, and back then, you know, it could be assumed that a convert would be observant. That is simply not the case, and I can prove that, but not in a podcast. I would say that those who think that one must commit to being an observant Jew, and it's got to take a long time, and you got to learn a lot of stuff, and blah, 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 all that stuff, they should open the books, and I will very shortly have an article on this published in Hebrew in a leading Torah journal. So if they read Hebrew, they should read it, and if they don't read Hebrew, they should learn Hebrew.
something that I remember that you mentioned when we spoke with you about this a few years ago was that I found really interesting is that you mentioned that accepting the mitzvot upon yourself is binding. Is a different animal than accepting that you will never transgress any mitzvot. Meaning, you know, like I can say, let's say you want to become a citizen of a country, you know, you say, I accept that all of the laws of this country are binding on me. You know, that if I jaywalk, that I will have to pay $300. I accept that this is the laws of my country and the people that I'm joining. But that doesn't mean that later, if I jaywalk, that my acceptance of the laws upon myself was never valid, that there's a difference between accepting to be bound by a system and accepting that you will never err within that system. And so with converts, I think, like, you know, Anne, you mentioned with Ivanka Trump, and people say, well, you know, the fact that she, you know, might be transgressing something, that proves that the original acceptance of the system on herself was not valid. And I think that's a mistake a lot of us make.
That is correct. That is correct. The term is in Hebrew is kabbalat mitzvot, at least ab initio. That's how you say lechatchila in English, except I think it's Latin. But anyway, the acceptance of the commandments, which is at least ab initio, a requirement of every convert, in acceptance of the commandments means this. I'm simplifying, but the convert will come to the Beit Din, to the rabbinic court, and say, I want to be Jewish. And the court will lehodia lahem mitzvot. They will explain to them that Judaism has a lot of requirements, commandments, and that there's these commandments bind everyone, and that there is punishment reward for people who don't do them versus do them. And then the convert will say, I still want to convert. That is kabbalat mitzvot, acceptance of the commandments. In other words, what the convert is saying, okay, you've told me that I'll be bound by the commandments and that there's punishment and reward, mikubal alai, in modern Hebrew would say, this is acceptable to me.
This
is acceptance of the commandments, in my opinion. Yes, there is dispute among the great rabbis as to what exactly this term means. In my opinion, it is the mainstream position, something which, again, I believe I can prove out, but not in a podcast.
I think we have just maybe one final question for you. How does all this whole story differ from that of someone who's born to Christian parents in America, who decides that they have, pardon the expression, seen the light and they want to be Jewish now? How is that different from this? I think that we can pull out some of the threads of what you said to figure it out, but I'd like to hear it straight from you.
So in general, conversion policy in Israel versus in the diaspora has been different for centuries, maybe since the Jerusalem versus Babylonian Talmud. For example, Rav Goren wrote about this extensively. The Babylonian Talmud has conflicting statements about converts, some positive and some negative. The Jerusalem Talmud has only positive things to say about converts. Rav Goren writes, and pretty convincingly, that the approach to conversion was always different in Israel versus the diaspora. And I think the reason is simple. If you live in Israel, without trying, you will convert sociologically. If you want to be part of the Jewish people, because it is the overwhelming culture in Israel, if you want to be Jewish, you will become Jewish, maybe not halachically, but in every other way.
Do you think that a tourist, a random Christian or nothing American who comes to Israel, settles in Israel, will also sociologically become Jewish?
So Rav Goren, it depends if they want to or not. Rav Goren used to convert, you know, back when the Europeans still liked us, there would be volunteers from all over the place, Sweden and Switzerland and God knows where else. If a Swedish non-Jew came to Israel on a totally secular kibbutz, fell in love with an Israeli Jew and decided to stay here, he would convert her. Because guess what? She's going to be Jewish, and so will her kids for sure, so sociologically speaking. So if that's the case, let's convert her halachically as well.
Thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure, Chuck. Again, I'm here with Rachel and Shoshana and Rabbi Chuck Davidson speaking about conversion. We are Chochmat Nashim. Reach us on our Facebook page, Chochmat Nashim, Chochmatnashim.
And don't forget to subscribe, leave a comment, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Can you hear us now?